Hi everyone, it's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. You know, one of the biggest questions I get on the show is, what exactly goes into a business exit plan, and when should I start creating mine? Well, I always tell people that the best time to start was 5 years ago, but the next best time is now because you never know when you might need it. So we put together a free report that describes what an exit plan is and what you should know. You can get it free by texting EXIT PLAN with no spaces to 44222. That's EXIT PLAN to 44222. Again, text EXIT PLAN to 44222.
Welcome to the Exit Coach Radio Show, the show for baby boomer business owners who are looking for cutting-edge information as they plan their 3 to 10 year business succession and exit. Every week, we interview top professional advisors for their best tips, strategies, and precautions so you can be well-planned. And don't miss our one-minute Exit Coach tip of the day on ExitCoachRadio.com. And now, here's your host, the Exit Coach, Bill Black.
Well, hello, everyone. Thanks so much for joining me today. Once again, I'm happy to have you with me and hope that you enjoy our interviews today. You know, let me ask you a question. You scrimp, you save, you run a business, you hire employees, you pay everybody everything. At the end of the day, somehow you manage to build up an estate. You manage to build up enough assets after the government's had their way with you that you now have something to protect. What are you doing to protect that, and is it enough? Well, those are some of the questions we're going to find out for today from my first guest, Craig Redler from the Jeffrey M. Verdon Law Group. And of course, the Jeffrey M. Verdon Law Group is no stranger to the show. Jeff's been on the show many times, talked about some interesting tactics and strategies that you can employ to protect those assets you work so hard to accumulate. So I'm going to bring Craig on right now. Craig, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for joining me this morning.
Good morning, Bill. Thanks for having me.
Craig, my pleasure. As I mentioned, Jeff's been on the show before from the Jeffrey Verdon Law Group, and he's told us some of the different types of strategies, and I think we're going to dig into some more of those. But first, I think our listeners would be interested to hear a little bit about you, about your background. Tell us about yourself.
I have a pretty unique background, I think I'm comfortable saying. I was practicing law in St. Louis, Missouri for about 20 years and had a pretty simple estate planning practice, wills, trusts, probate, that sort of thing, just kind of routine stuff. And I saw an opportunity to take a job with an offshore trustee in the Cook Islands, a small chain of islands in the South Pacific. Sent him a letter. About 3 months later, I'm living on a tiny little island called Rarotonga, working for a trustee that administers these asset protection trusts. So I stayed on this little island for about a year. And they sent me over to Tauranga, New Zealand, to work in a new office over there that we had just opened. So I stayed in Tauranga for about a year and had an opportunity to work for a bigger company in Auckland. So I jumped from the first company and then lived in Auckland for about 3 years. And through these various positions, I became acquainted with Jeff and moved back to the USA from Auckland, New Zealand, just under a year ago, and reacquainted with Jeff. And now I'm out here in Southern California writing the trusts I used to administer when I was over in the Cooks and in New Zealand.
Well, you got that right, that's an unusual path that you took, and an interesting one. I'm sure you have some great stories about migrating over to this little island. I think a lot of people, you know, we think about these asset protection havens like the Cook Islands or other places like Nevis, you know, just different places around the world, and we think, you know, it sounds like it's one big building that houses all of these trusts surrounded by paradise. What is it really like over there?
That's one of the impressions that people get, that there are these ivory towered granite buildings over there with all these banks. Or the other impression of these little islands is that they're just absolutely primitive, and the truth is somewhere in between. It's a little island. The island probably has less people living on it than the office building that are in this office building I'm sitting in right now. So it is pretty small, but it has all the modern amenities, and then the buildings are, you know, if you were walking down, to the extent there's anything that resembles a city there, it's called Avarua, and if you're walking down a street, which basically it is a street in Avarua, it would be pretty unremarkable. But, you know, the people that work there are very professional, and they're not I don't know what kind of impression people have of Polynesians, but they're very professional and they know what they're doing. It's their native language there is English, and they follow English common law, and the court system would be familiar to most Americans, and the government's stable, and it's perfectly legitimate.
Yeah, of course. So one of the big questions I think our listeners might have, I hear this question all the time, is, okay, so then what's the big deal? Why does it have to be way down there, so far away? Kind of illuminate our listeners for a little bit. Why is it important to have your assets, if you're going to do some of these offshore type of trusts to protect your assets, why is it such a big deal to be so far down there and so far away?
There are two main reasons for that. Primarily, the trust laws in the Cook Islands in particular and some of the other jurisdictions, one of which you mentioned, Nevis, and some of the other ones, are specifically written for this purpose. So they are perfectly tailored for what our clients are trying to achieve. They're very debtor-friendly. And again, we're not suggesting that you don't pay your debts, that you don't pay your creditors when you set one of these things up. But what they do is they encourage settlement. They eliminate the probability or even possibility of runaway jury verdicts and things like that. And I can say from working as a trustee, I've actually seen these things work over and over. And I've seen it's the laws of the jurisdiction just encourage settlement, and they get our clients what they're looking for. And that's primarily it. The secondarily is just diversification. Most Americans are under the impression that U.S. banks and U.S. financial institutions are just solid and beyond reproach. And as we saw in 2008, they're just not. So setting up in a foreign jurisdiction can give you access to banks and financial institutions that you may or may not have ready access to here, and some of which are more financially solid than you're going to find here. Now, banks in Switzerland, banks in Hong Kong, banks in any number of other places really are superior in a lot of ways to American banks, for better or for worse.
So what's the other obstacle, the truth about the other obstacle I've heard, which is that if you have your assets placed in trusts in islands like such as you're talking about, an attorney that's for the person that might be suing you, trying to attack you, can't just phone it in. They have to physically. Is it true they have to physically go down and file a suit in which is another obstacle again to slow things down a little bit?
Is
it true that they have
to?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, no, that's, again, going back to what I said earlier about the laws being favorable. The laws in the Cook Islands in particular, under the Cook Island law, they just flat do not recognize foreign judgments from anywhere. So if you were to show up in the Cook Islands with a judgment from an American bank or from an American court or a Canadian court or a European court, they would just disregard it. So really the only way to access funds that are held in one of these trusts is to, like you said, file a suit in the Cook Islands or wherever you have the entity set up, assuming the laws follow this track, and you have to allege fraudulent transfer. So you're not even going to file your underlying claim there. You're gonna have to go get a judgment here first, then wherever you're filing your suit, and then go over there and demonstrate to the court. And by the way, the fraudulent transfer law there is considerably more difficult to navigate than most of the ones you're going to see here. So you have to go over there and show that assets were placed in the trust specifically. And by the way, the standard is beyond reasonable doubt. It's the same standard we use for criminal cases here, which is the highest burden of proof for a plaintiff. You have to show beyond reasonable doubt that the assets were placed in trust specifically to defraud you, not creditors in general, but you as a particular creditor. So, I did litigation work for several years before I got into estate planning. And without some kind of smoking gun, I really don't even know how you could do that. But beyond that, the statute's limitations for doing that are very, very short. So, again, mm-hmm. just sort of fell this way. But before you could even get over there, before you could get over to the Cook Islands, which isn't an easy place to get, by the way,
mm-hmm.
you have to get a judgment here, and by the time you do that, typically the statute of limitations for approving fraudulent transfer is going to have run anyway. So it's really, really difficult maze to kind of find your way through if you're really trying to attack one of these things.
And as you mentioned, so the key to some of this stuff is not to it's not tax motivated. It's just basically to put some of your stuff in a place that is not easy to get to, has friendly laws to debtors, as you mentioned, and also requires extra steps to where if you're the attorney that's suing that individual that has all this put together, you're looking at that and saying, wow, this is going to be difficult and expensive, right?
Yes, exactly. And there are only a few attorneys on the island, actually. It's funny, when I was there was an election, and I think three attorneys were running for parliament at the time, and there was actually a editorial in one of the newspapers that they were going to have a shortage of attorneys if they all won. So it's difficult to find a lawyer over there, and typically when clients do, or plaintiffs and creditors try and do this, they have to go to New Zealand to get a lawyer. And so you're going to have to pay a guy from New Zealand to come over to the Cook Islands, and you're giving him a tropical vacation, basically, with the likelihood of him succeeding being very small. So you see very quickly from the point of view of a plaintiff, your best strategy is to settle.
Got it. Well, that you just clarified things that I hear a lot of questions about. I really appreciate that. And I know, you know, that one of the things that separates what the Jefford Verdon Law Group does from other estate planning law firms is you have a specialty and expertise as a firm in these particular types of strategies. And, you know, Craig, a lot of our listeners are business owners, baby boomers, that are saying someday my very complicated business asset is going to be sold, and it's going to be sold for a very easy-to-attack asset like cash. And I need to probably do something so that I don't get attacked. Tell our listeners, if you could talk to that point, you know, why is it important to do asset protection like this in this day and age?
It's critical, and I think it fits very well with what you know, the theme of this show. It's amazing, and I've seen this again as a trustee, and I saw it when I was a litigation attorney. It when people sell their businesses, a couple things happen, and what you just said is certainly the first consideration. All of a sudden, you've got all this cash, which is very easy to access by anybody. If you go out and just have a car accident, it's there and it's vulnerable. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, I think it's not uncommon when you sell a business, the real high percentage of the buyers come back later with complaints and file mm-hmm. suits. You know, I did my due diligence, and the financials you provided me were wrong. You know, never mind the fact I started the business. I've been running the business for 20 years. Of course I'm going to run it better than someone who steps in later. That aside, they point the finger at the seller and come back looking for compensation or remuneration for, later down the line. So it really is an excellent time to think about setting one of these things up. And again, to the theme of exiting your business, this is something that we say around here a lot. You can do estate planning, and you can do all this beautiful planning and do a wonderful trust and make sure that your assets pass without having to deal with probate and all the things that most people are looking at when they do estate planning. But none of that does you any good if you don't have an estate left when it comes time to retire or when you pass away. So when you work with us, our primary goal is to make sure that you always have an estate.
Good point. You know, so you, something to consider, listeners. You think about what Craig is saying here is that maybe you're fighting the wrong enemy when you do your estate planning. You're fighting basically the IRS and the transfer system that's been set up that makes it difficult for I've had this happen for a widow, for instance, to sell a business without going through probate after her husband dies who owns the business. There has to be title clearing and all those types of things. That's what estate planning fights. This is really saying those assets that you have from that sale are now subject to attack, and it's time to basically think about ways to slow down that attack, to build, hate to use the analogy, but build walls around those assets. Craig, and that's what you guys do. So, we've heard, some people say, well, you know what, you really don't have to go offshore for that. But why go offshore, why would people consider, is there a certain level of assets that they get to, or is it because there are more risks and they really need to think about going offshore?
Two big reasons for that. And we do some domestic asset protection for clients who aren't comfortable going offshore. And look, excuse me, I can tell you, I worked at a trust company. I am the face of that trust company. I know it's difficult for some people to put faith in a trustee in a remote location, somebody they don't know. But so if someone can't get over that hurdle, we do some domestic planning. But at the end of the day, it's inferior, and it's inferior for a couple reasons. One, going back to what I said earlier, the laws in places like the Cook Islands are brilliantly crafted to do what they do. Now, there are a couple states that have tried to emulate them somewhat, and most people know them, the usual suspects. It's South Dakota, it's Wyoming, it's Nevada, it's Alaska, it's Delaware. Ultimately, the problem with doing domestic asset protection planning is twofold. One is full faith and credit in the Constitution. That is to say, if you get a judgment in one state, all the other states are obliged under the U.S. Constitution to recognize it. So if you're a California resident and I get a judgment against you in California and you have your trust set up in Nevada and I show up in Nevada with my California judgment, it is quite possible the Nevada court is going to honor that judgment without asking much questions. California doesn't recognize self-settled spendthrift trust, which ultimately is what these things are, where Nevada does. So the Nevada court has to honor the California judgment. The other issue is federal supremacy. Any suit that involves a federal claim is going to be, a federal court's going to summarily ignore a state asset protection trust. And then there's bankruptcy. Under the bankruptcy law, the bankruptcy courts can claw back assets that you funded into a trust for up to 10 years. So, again, you're offshore. Once your assets are offshore, they're offshore. They're not subject to being clawed back in bankruptcy, into a bankruptcy estate. So, it just comes down to those two issues as much as anything.
Yeah, and you're explaining it perfectly clearly. It makes a lot of sense. One last question here I have for you this morning is we hear a lot about the IRS getting involved with things offshore. Are we wrong to associate the fact that the IRS doesn't like things offshore? Or tell
yes.
us a little bit about
you're
that.
Wrong.
Okay, good.
The IRS actually prints forms specifically designed. We're not excuse me. We're not trying to hide assets from the IRS. Mm-hmm. When you set up an offshore entity, you're still going to pay your taxes, just like they're here or anywhere else. And as long as you tell the IRS it's out there and you pay your taxes, they don't care. These things have never, in my experience, triggered an audit by virtue of their mere existence. And if the IRS didn't want you doing it, they wouldn't print regulations and forms that allow you to do it.
Right. Makes sense. Right. So, Craig, you explained all of this beautifully. Now, what's a first step for a listener who might be saying, I want to talk more. I want to learn more about this. How do they start with you and the Jeff Verdon Law Firm, Craig?
If you give us a call, we'll have a short phone consultation and just ask you some brief questions and just tell you what we do a little bit and make sure that you're in a position where we can help you. And if it looks like it's something you're still interested in, then we go ahead and have you come in. We've got a web excuse me, I'm sorry, I've got a bit of a cold. We've got a website with some really, really good preliminary information, and there's even a little quiz on the website that you can get a feel for just how exposed you may or may not be. So that's jmvlaw.com if you want to check that. But really, it starts with a phone call. Give me a call. Give Jeff a call, and we're happy to chat with you and see if we could do business together.
Tell us the best number to call for that.
949, we're in Newport Beach, 949-333-8149, 949-333-8149 in Newport Beach.
Thanks for repeating that. So also, again, jmvlaw.com. Craig, again, I've known Jeff for many years, and the firm does incredibly great work, great reputation in the area. And you've really lent another facet of clarity and answered a lot of questions that only someone who's spent as interesting a life as you could know these things firsthand, and it really helps people who are concerned about whether they should be doing these strategies, find out more about that. So thank you so much for joining me today, and I think you should come on again so we can dig into some more strategies at some point.
Happy to. Anytime, I would be thrilled to.
All right. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Appreciate it, Bill. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us. We've had some very interesting interviews. That was one of the best interviews I think I've heard about such a esoteric and what can seem like a complicated field. But my next guest is going to help us learn about some different types of items. She's a veteran entrepreneur of 14 years, and her name is Carrie Kathleen Heaps, and she's going to help us learn about leveraging your publicity to close more deals. She has some books on this called Bodies Don't Lie, Body Language Basics, and the Significance of Color in Wardrobe and the Psychology Behind It, something called The Network Game, Making Networking Work for Your Business, and Follow-Up Tips for Success. She's the founder of Book Speak Repeat, a speaker submission service that helps new and seasoned speakers through the difficult maze of finding and applying for speaking engagements. So, Carrie, thank you so much for joining me today. Welcome to the show.
Bill, thank you so much for having me today. It's such an honor to be here with you in the audience.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It's our pleasure. You know, you're bringing some interesting information to us. A lot of our listeners are professional advisors and business owners who often find themselves in situations where they would like to network or promote or speak. So tell us a little bit about you and your background and how you started Book Speak Repeat.
Well, I have a pretty varied background. I've been an entrepreneur for 14 years, and I started out actually going back into the modeling and pageant industry when I first started out. That was my intent. But as we all know, as entrepreneurs, it's never a straight line. I was asked a lot to start networking events and start different chapters in different areas and help build up networking chapters for different organizations. And so much work went into that. I said, while I'm building up my business, I think I'm going to start doing this because a lot of work goes into it. I might as well get myself paid to do it. And, my pageantry and all of the things that I really like to do, working with people, kind of went on the back burner for many years. And I started doing trade shows and networking events, and that kind of bloomed into people asking me to help them with their sales and marketing.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't until, a few years ago that I actually made some drastic changes in my business after a personal incident that happened to me. And I got back into speaking, because when I first started my business, I did a lot of speaking and I got away from that for several years. So I just recently got back into it a couple of years ago. And what prompted me to start Book Speak Repeat is we were already helping business owners get more media coverage for their business and how to use that to leverage it to close more sales. And going through the speaking process, and anybody who is in the industry knows what I'm talking about, there's a lot of work that's involved, finding speaking engagements, going through the application process, doing follow-up, and then just, once you get booked, being on that speaker's calendar and what you have to do. And I thought to myself, I have a process. I've done a lot of research. I have a good database. And I thought, I might as well help other speakers do this because I know it's a pain point for a lot of people. And I wanted to be able to help with that. So here we are, 14 years later. And I, have this organization where I help people get more media exposure and get more speaking engagements.
You're absolutely right, Carrie. It is, as someone who speaks myself, I know it's the hardest part is, you know, finding the gig. You know, you call me with a speaking gig, I'm ready.
Mm-hmm.
That part's easy. I'm ready to go. But it's
right.
That finding that. And so I notice, okay, so the title of your company is very intentional. Book, speak, repeat. It's in that order for a good reason. So when someone
exactly.
wants to get started in the speaking industry, what advice would you offer if they're getting started?
Well, a couple of things. We do consults all the time with different speakers, you know, some that are beginners or intermediate, you know, they've been speaking a few years, and then we have some that we work with that have been in the industry for many, many years. And first and foremost, what I tell everybody is you need to have I have people that will come to me and tell me, I want to be a speaker. I'm like, okay, great. What do you want to talk about? And then they kind of draw a blank. Well, that's the first thing you need to do. You've got to have a topic, a good topic. You need to come up, sit down and write, take out a sheet of paper, write down what your topic mm-hmm. is. And then write up a little summary, you know, like a short paragraph of what that topic is about. You know, mm-hmm. what makes you so passionate about it, what it is that you're going to learn, you know, by introducing this topic, what you can teach other people. And then you want to take that and you want to come up with anywhere from 3 to 5 takeaways. So if I signed up for your speaking engagement, Bill, what are 5 things that when I'm done listening to you, I am going to be able to say, hey, now I know how to, and you just kind of fill in the blank. So you always mm-hmm. want to have a topic, a summary, and 3 to 5 takeaways. I have some speakers who come to me, they have 20 different topics, and I'm like, look, that's way too many. Narrow it down to 3, the 3 that you are the best at. So that is first and foremost, you have to have that. And the reason you want it in that format is because so many meeting planners now utilize what's called a call for speakers, which is a form that you have to fill out with all your contact information, and they want the exact same thing. They want to know the topic of your workshop or training or breakout session or keynote, and they want a description of it. Then they want 3 to 5 takeaways. And these are things that they ask for those for a reason. You know, if they do choose you to speak, they're going to pull those and put that in their marketing material. But you need to have that from the get-go. The other thing that you really need to do is – you know, you need to create a plan of how you're going to attack this. So if you're a brand new speaker and you're bootstrapping it, maybe working with a submission process or a submission service or a speaker's brew is not the best thing for you. So you might want to start doing it on your own. So you need to figure out how much time per week you're going to spend with that, because it can be very time consuming. Figure out what type of events you want to talk to. What audiences do you want to get in front of? Are you willing to be a paid speaker? Are you willing to do unpaid as well? So you have to kind of figure out a good game plan of how you're going to approach that. So once you kind of have all of that going, you kind of get going, and then you just have to start searching. And there's several different ways you can do that. Events in America is a great site for people who are looking for events to you know, that are coming up in the coming years. Typically in the speaking industry, we find for trade shows and associations, they're booking now for summertime of next year. So you got to start early. You know, your efforts, the seeds that you're planting now are going to bloom later on. You know, you start to see results from that. It's a process. And it's just, that would be the other thing I would say, is to tell speakers, really, there's a process there. You got to trust the process, and you got to work it consistently.
Terrific. Well, those are some great tips. So, you know, get ready, have a plan of attack, and know where to look, and plan well ahead. Great tips. Now, getting back to the company name, Book, Speak, Repeat. So, how important is it to have that book before you hit the speaking trail?
Well, when I talk about my version of book is talking about booking the engagement.
But
I'm so glad that you brought that up, Bill, because yes, having a book is key. I have so many speakers that we work with that are so adamant on having a speaker's reel, you know, that one, you know, 50 second to, you know, 2 minute video of them showcasing their speaking. And I have to tell you, with all of the submissions that we do, probably 50% of the time we're asked for a video of the speaker. You know what the number one thing that they ask for? Are they a published author? And if so, mm-hmm. I want a link to where I can find their book. So mm-hmm. actually having a book is hugely, I can't even express how important it is. You know, even if you just did a short book, a mini book, so to speak, I've published a couple of those. A good friend of mine, Alicia Nicole Waters, helped me through that process. She has a great program for that. And it's something that you can do rather quickly. People think that it's, you know, kind of a huge undertaking. And even if you just have a mini book, something that you can give them, something that they can read and just have a different aspect of what your message is about. So it actually kind of ties in a different way about the book, but it is very, very important. We get asked that question on just about every submission we fill out for speakers.
Terrific. Okay. Well, thank you for going down that rabbit hole with me. I guess I jumped on that because I see, you know, when you see people speaking on TV, they almost always, if not always, have a book. You know, when you watch the talk shows, they have a book or a movie that they're promoting. Nobody comes on just to talk hardly anymore.
Right. And it seems, you know, it seems a little ironic because you would think, well, I want to go speak. And you know, a book is a written word. It's not a you know, me communicating verbally. But it is very important. And I think that they, you know, a lot of meeting planners really want speakers who are well-rounded. Mm-hmm. You know, meaning that they're, you know, they have a message to share, but they can share it in different ways. And it's also an opportunity for a meeting planner, if they see that you have a book, that, okay, great, they can go and look at that over the weekend, or they can, you know, order a copy and just read it at their leisure or flip through it. So it's just a way for them to communicate their message, you know, get your message in a different way. But it is very important. We get that question a lot, and it does hurt people when they don't have a book.
Great, great, great. Thank you very much. So let me ask you a question. What type of events are out there that pay speakers, or should speakers plan on speaking for free?
Well, you know, there's tons of events out there, and it's a consistent cycle. You know, we had someone who asked us the other day, they said, oh, this must be your slow time of year. I'm like, are you kidding me? I need extra help right now. You know, mm-hmm. so it's consistent. It's year round. There's always companies and trade shows and associations that are looking for speakers. You know, anymore, it's very hard to tell until they're interested in you. Sometimes they disclose up front whether they pay or not. Mm-hmm. And you have to kind of make that decision if you're willing to speak for free. You know, so a lot of times you don't really know what their budget is or what they're willing to pay or what they can pay until after they express interest in you. So, again, it's a lot of applying. I would equate it to almost like you're consistently filling out employment applications because every organization's different. I have associations and trade shows that, you know, they've come back to our speakers and they have as low as $500 that they will pay for a workshop. And I have some that are, you know, for a keynote, they're paying anywhere from $7,000 to $10,000. On the private side, to, you know, do a training, to come into a private company or work a private event. For example, maybe something like T. Rowe Price is looking for a speaker to come in to, you know, talk at their annual company meeting. So you're just talking to their employees. They typically do pay on the higher side, not to say that they don't negotiate, because they all do, but
sure.
They do tend to have more of a budget rather than the associations and the trade shows and the smaller shows that you see out there. That, you know, might not be able to pay anything at all, or they can just cover travel. So it just depends. It's not something that's clear cut, because every single organization has a different process.
Yeah, absolutely. Makes a lot of sense. I mean, I think it's important to be savvy about that. And when someone asks you what you charge, you know, you probably have a great tip for that. You might want to turn that back around on them and say, well, what's your budget? Because you might be surprised, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I've had people come back to me and say, oh, you know, I booked an engagement and I was paid $10,000, and they name the organization. And I'm kind of thinking to myself, I kind of know that those people don't pay mm-hmm. that amount. So, you know, every one of them is different. And it's really, it's just one of those things that you have to apply. And sometimes they'll come back and it might be an opportunity for you as a speaker that, hey, maybe they're not paying me what I want, but I'll be able to get in front of 150 business owners that if I can close 10 of them to be clients, you know, after the fact, then it's well worth my time. So each person has to individually sit down and figure out, you know, will this be worth my time? Is this something that I can do? Am I going to lose money on it? Is it something that I want to do? And again, that all goes back to the beginning part of it. You have to kind of figure out what exactly is your goal with speaking. My goal, because I speak as well, and it's just, it's really a sideline for me. I love doing it, but I have other things going on. So if somebody needs to negotiate with me, I'm always open to doing that but I have my limits too. But it really just depends on the speaker and what their situation is.
Great. I'm talking with Carrie Kathleen Heaps of Book, Speak, Repeat. We're talking about different strategies for finding and speaking at different types of venues and events. Carrie, what are some of the big mistakes you see speakers make that could cost them a speaking gig?
A couple of things. The biggest one is they're not promoting themselves enough, and that's two different ways. First way, meaning you need to, even if you work with a speaker's bureau, you still need to do submissions on your own. Now, if you have someone internally that can help you with that, like an assistant or an intern, and you trust them and you know that they have the life experience to find speaking gigs for you and apply, then definitely have them do it. You know, try to dedicate 5 hours a week to that. You know, you should be able to get, you know, at least 10 submissions out of that, even if you're slow doing it. So, you know, definitely promote yourself, you know, still apply on your own, even though you have other people that are helping you. Never put all your eggs in one basket. The flip side of that is that I don't see them getting interviewed as much. You know, I see a lot of speakers who will turn down opportunities. They'll turn down a podcast or they'll turn down writing an article for a blog. And where this can really hurt you and where it can help you is if you don't have any kind of media exposure that, you know, could be affiliated with a particular event. And I'll give you a great example. This year I spoke at the WWETT, the Wastewater and Environmental Treatment Show. It's the largest show in the wastewater industry. 30,000 people go to that show. When I applied, I actually applied to speak on body language. And I did not, that was one of the ones that asked me if I, you know, for a link for video, like a video link of me speaking, which I don't have one. So what I did is I had been asked several, I don't know, maybe 2 years ago to be on a contractor's show. It was a radio program for plumbers, electricians, and this person heard me on another podcast, so I was happy to do it. And the reason I sent that one is because it was still, we talked about a lot of things that were similar to audience engagement that would be going on at this show. So I just said, here's a show that I did on the contractor's radio program. I think you'll really enjoy it. I talk about being the daughter of a contractor because my father was an electrician. And they came back to me and they said, 300 women that come to this show every year out of the 30,000. And we only, you know, we only want two people on the women's track. I want you, but I want you to do succeeding in a male dominated industry. Would you be up for doing that? So it was kind of a motivational speech. So of course I jumped at it. It was my first time doing that. But that is actually what closed the deal for the meeting planner. She listened to the show. She listened because I knew she did because I didn't mention I was the daughter of a contractor. She heard from the show. So they do listen to your media interviews and it tied in. And I thought when I did this particular program, most people would turn it down thinking, well, I'll never get anything out of that. Well, not only did I get to speak this year, I've been invited back to go back next year. And I've been, you know, making contacts with other meeting planners because it is such a big show that Informa puts on. So you never know where those opportunities are going to come from. So I find that, you know, they'll get something in and they're like, oh, that doesn't really seem like it would be a good thing.
Right,
you need
right,
to show up
right.
everywhere. And so that's something that I see a lot of them. It can cost you a speaking engagement and it shouldn't.
Yeah, that's great advice in life in general is don't pre-assume what's going to happen once you get there. You just never know what might happen with an opportunity. So, right. So what I've heard you say so far is get ready, have a plan of attack, and show up, right?
Show up and take
them as they come. It's great advice, Carrie, and we've only got about another minute left, so I want to give you a chance to tell our listeners how best to find out more about what you do at Book Speak Repeat. So tell us about how to get in touch with you best.
Okay, great. I would just say go directly to the website bookspeakrepeat.com, and that's spelled just like it sounds, bookspeakrepeat.com. We have on there a form you can fill out for a free consultation. Once you fill that out, my office will set that up, and you'll actually have a consultation with me. If I can't help you, I at least want to be able to give you some tips to help you where you can work independently. So I'd love to have a conversation with anyone.
It's terrific. It's great information. Listeners, give me 10 minutes to get there first, will you please? Because I really need help with this type of topic. Carrie, you've been a real delight to talk with this morning. I really have appreciated your professional insight and great takeaways ourselves. So thank you so much for joining me, and I look forward to talking with you again sometime in the future.
Thank you, Bill, and thank you so much for everything that you do for entrepreneurs everywhere. We just love the show.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you. That's very kind of you. All right. Thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a real pleasure to have you so far. You know, we've had some great speakers already this morning, some great guests. And my next, I've saved the best for last. And she is Fong Jennings. She's with QBI LLC. And Fong is just a great individual, a really delight of a person to know. And her business is a TPA. Do you know what that is, listeners? It's third-party administrator, TPA. And they focus on being the expert in plan design, administration, and compliance for qualified retirement plans. And you all know what those are, like the 401ks, the profit sharings, the defined benefit plans. And we're going to talk about plan design because it's really foundational for the success of the plan and its participants. You know, poor plan design can mean the owners are losing out on saving dollars on taxes or perhaps facing compliance issues in the future, which could cost a lot of money to the owners. So, Fong, thanks so much for joining me this morning and welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Bill. Thank you for such a kind introduction. You're too kind. So I'm very excited to be on the show and share a little bit about what we do, and hopefully that this will be helpful to your listeners out there, because it's definitely an area of, what I feel is kind of a clear as mud to a lot of business owners. You know, they want to do these things,
right,
but it just seems very, complex, and it's not very clear and not very transparent. So let's kind of demystify some of this.
Yeah, you're right. Almost every employer that you talk to today says, I want to be competitive, especially in a very full work environment. I want to be competitive to attract the best and the brightest. But one of the things I need to offer is a qualified retirement plan, because everybody else does. But often they choose something that is off the shelf. They think it's easy. I'll just do this package approach. And we're going to talk about some of the mistakes they can make when that happens, or when they're not getting the right support in that, Fong. But first, tell us a little bit about you and your background and how you got into this line of work.
Definitely. Gosh, I've been doing this for so long. This has been actually my whole career. It's been about 18 years when I first got started in the industry, just a rookie, trying to figure out what to do. And so I would say I stumbled or fell into the 401k world. Don't think I really grew up thinking, hey, I'm going to, set up retirement plans and work on compliance. But I have found a passion for it. It's been wonderful to help, the average American save for retirement. So that's definitely a big reward. So like I said, 18 years ago, fell into this and started in the world of legal documents compliance. So I started with a small TPA and really had worked my way through the inside of all the different areas of retirement plans. So from legal documents to compliance, administration, to managing and the retirement plans, to now really being in the forefront of sitting down with the business owners and helping them strategize and create the right and, you know, plan for their company.
So I heard a rumor that when you were small, your parents came in and you were playing with blocks and you had aligned them into 401k. that's not true then, I guess.
No, unfortunately not. But, when you've been doing it for so long, it kind of feels like I probably was. Those were probably my first three blocks, 401 with a K.
Okay, well, let's start with the notion of a TPA. I think a lot of our listeners that might have a plan, especially if they have a small kind of a packaged plan, just say, well, why would I need a TPA? I have a plan provider, like a company that does all the investments, and they do all the record keeping. Why would I need someone on the outside, a third party administrator, at all?
Sure. And that is a wonderful, great question, because a lot of the times, you know, what we do as a TPA, there's not a lot of light shine on all the working mechanism that goes behind plan design administration. So, you know, even for participants, you know, when they get a statement, you know, can say Fidelity or John Hancock, you know, they know nothing about what is going on behind the scenes to make sure that the plan is in compliant, that all the regulatory filings are being done, that the plan is non-discriminatory, you know, it's designed in a non-discriminatory manner. So, and all the different measures that, you know, our government likes to put in place to make sure that, you know, because you're taking advantage of the tax savings, basically. So, you know, the participants are saving money in taxes, you know, it lowers their taxable income by doing a salary deferral, but the company also gets a, you know, big tax deduction for making those employer contributions. So, with that being said, Uncle Sam isn't going to let you do that without making sure you go through all the hoops. And so for us as a TPA, that's what we're doing behind the scenes. So to answer your question, as far as plan design is concerned, and you really hit it the nail on the head earlier, Bill, is that it's not a, you know, a cookie cutter approach definitely can be done. And it's done where, you know, and the way I like to explain it is, you know, anybody can file their personal taxes using maybe, you know, TurboTax. But why is it that if you have a business or if you want to really be, you know, have a more strategic, hands-on approach and have, you know, maximize potential to, you know, getting your taxes done, that you sit down with a CPA, that you go through the specialized, you know, people. And so that's what we do is, we're looking at it with lenses of looking at your senses and designing all the little working behind the scenes of one provision that could trigger another provision. And by having the right, the right features in place could allow that business owner to maximize versus not and leaving money on the table. You're not going to get that with, you know, the kind of bundled provider where, you know, it's on the shelf, you know, here it is, here's the model, you know, not two plans are alike, but hey, this is all we have to offer. And you have to go with, you know, these simple in the box provisions that they offer.
Let's break that down for a second, Fong, and talk about, you know, a lot of people, as we said earlier, they'll start a plan. You know, it's like, what's the big deal? I've got 50 employees. I'm going to start a plan. They're going to be putting in small amounts. It's not that big of a deal. But a few years go by, and now that plan has some significant assets in it. And at that point, they might be saying, you know, I don't know if I'm doing the right thing here. What's an example of something where you've come into a plan that's already in place and told the owner, hey, did you know you could do this? And they say, I didn't know I could do that. Can you give us like one or two examples of things that you found that you think, wow, we would have done this right out of the gate, and you find that big mistakes people that are making?
Absolutely. So I can quickly give you two examples. There's actually one that I'm working on right now that I'm taking over, a medical practice, and they only have really about 15 or so employees. But they're growing. They just acquired another facility, so they'll probably have about 30. But what they were told by their current provider is that the two owners could not participate because by their participation into the plan and having the rest of the employees, the rank and file, if you will, by their low participation, the owners, if they put money in, they're going to have a refund back because they're not passing the non-discrimination testing. And so, so they've withheld putting money in, and the owners are, you're looking at, 50, 55 years old, and they don't have a retirement, but they're just figuring, hey, that's what we were told. We can't contribute. It's only for our employees. So when we were introduced to, when I was introduced to them, we sat down and we said, hey, why are you not, participating? And they just said, well, we were told we can't because we would have to get that money back. So we're redesigning that plan to add safe harbor, and you'll hear that a lot in our industry, is that by having a safe harbor plan, it's just an added feature that will allow the owners to maximize their 401k salary contribution. So for this year, these two owners can put in $24,500 max in their deferrals. And also, and all they have to really give out is either a 3% safe harbor or a 4% safe harbor match. There's the two options. Because of the low participation, they can do the 4% match. So that allows their employees, they're going to give them this 4% or up to 4% contribution. However, it's only if these employees participate themselves. So they have to have skin in the game. So it's very attractive, and it's, we're going to set them up to be successful for next year because it's too late to do it for 2018, but we're going to add the safe harbor provision, and they're very happy that they can start contributing and start really catching up on their retirement because they haven't been able to.
Yeah, I'll bet they wish they had a time machine. They could go back about five or so years and put that money in for the last 5 years because it really starts to accumulate to a lot. It's a huge lost opportunity in that situation. A lot of people get really confused by where does all this safe harbor language come up with? It's really just a way to say the IRS has blessed this approach. It's safe. It's okay to do this. It's a safe harbor. You have to follow certain rules, and then you're able to do a lot more for yourself or for others. So understanding that and testing your plan to see if it makes sense to do that, very key. What's your other example, Fong?
My other example has to do with, it's a pharmacy, and they're doing compound type of, medicine. So a lot of money has been made and been around for, I think, over 20 years or so in business. But when we, it was just a 401k where, the owner was maxing out at $1,000 a year because that's including catch-up and profit sharing and safe harbor contribution. But nobody talked to him about doing a defined benefit plan. And so when we added this other component, this secondary plan that allows for, in conjunction with the existing 401k plan, allows him to now put away, for himself, another $200,000.
Wow.
And when he saw that design, and he's been paying taxes for many, many years, a lot of taxes. And so when he saw this design, he was just blown away. Like, how come nobody's told me about this? I could have done all this, save, all this money on taxes and contribute this much to my retirement. That was something that his, prior TPA or did not sit down and go through and really give him that additional guidance. And so that's another example of how, plan design is so essential because it can really allow the owners to maximize the key folks to maximize, because they're the ones that we typically are designing our plan to target, to have the biggest impact, because they are the ones that are running the show. And it's a big reward for the owners want to take care of their key, you know, guys or gals.
It's a shame that they're operating under these myths, or maybe the laws have changed or their business situation has changed and they just didn't think to get it looked at again. And unfortunately, as you say, you know, a lot of times they're working with a vendor that's perfectly fine, but they're just not proactive in coming to them and saying, hey, let me ask you a few questions. Let's see if we can, if you're doing this intentionally and missing out on these opportunities, or if you just didn't know about them. So it's really key to, I mean, get in touch with someone like you and say, hey, can you just look at this and see if I'm doing it correctly? It's really important as time goes by, because these are huge opportunities people were missing out on to save a lot of money towards their retirement. And in those defined benefit plans, you mentioned $200,000. That's a huge amount. If the stars line up right, somebody might say, yeah, but if I put in $200,000, I have to share, I don't know, I might have to share a lot with my employees. But if the stars line up right, that's not the case, right?
That's absolutely correct. There are ways to do that, and that's all kind of part of the creativity of plan design. So I would share that, you know, definitely with the defined benefit plan, you know, we're looking at the age, compensation, you know, there's a disparity that we do need to run the numbers, you know, based on the census. But like you said, the stars are aligned right. And typically, you know, something to keep in mind is that, you know, typically if the owners are about 10 years older or more than about 50% of their employee staff, we could limit that, you know, to around maybe about 7.5% going to the employees. And so, you know, the employees are usually making a lot less than the owners. You know, you're looking at, you know, when adding in a DB plan, you could look at, you know, an owner at around age, you know, 40 could probably put in that additional defined benefit plan of about, let's say, $111,000. At age 50, about $190,000, and at age 60, we're looking at $250,000 and upward into just a defined benefit plan for, you know, themselves.
Now, think about this, listener. Think of, for listeners that might be thinking, wow, that sounds incredible. Think about this. You're probably spending more than 50% of that in taxes if you just take it as a distribution. So if you have to share 7% with your employees as opposed to 50%+ with the government, isn't that a much better outcome? Isn't it worth asking a few questions and having someone like Fong take a look at your plan and you know, chance that, well, maybe the stars don't line up in your situation. That's the potential, but the potential is that it is. So there's some incredible opportunities for listeners. Now, one of the things that I've heard, Fong, is that sole proprietors without employees can do a lot more than they used to be able to do, or maybe they didn't know about that. Can you talk about that situation?
Absolutely. Sole proprietors, you know, owners only are the best candidate to do these types of scenario 401k with a defined benefit plan, because there's no employees to, you know, discriminate against, and they can really just give it to themselves. So, you know, you're looking at the professionals that are, you know, maybe it's a doctor, lawyer, or any type of professional where it's just them, and maybe it's them and the spouse. They can really create these plans where they put away those numbers that I mentioned, and it goes directly to them. They have both advantages. They have the 401k side where they lower their taxable income, right, out of their, you know, W-2 income, or, you know, net Schedule C or what have you not. But then on the other flip side is that on the employer contribution side, which is any profit sharing contribution and match or the defined benefit contribution, that's all coming out of the company or the corporation, and it's 100%, you know, tax deductible.
Well, that's a pretty good outcome for people. That is this something, you know, people say, well, if I do a defined benefit kind of plan, don't I have to have some kind of a commitment, because I don't know if my next year will be as good as my last year? What is the minimum commitment level for keeping a defined benefit plan or a cash balance type of a plan open for?
Correct. Yes. So I always discuss this with, you know, any potential prospects on looking into these types of plans. We want to make sure that there is going to be a confident commitment level of at least 3 years, because that's what the IRS wants to see. So I would say, you know, if you're able to do, you know, this type of a contribution of 3 to 5 years, then you're a good candidate. Because anything, you know, lower than 3 years is going to raise a red flag. You know, Uncle Sam wants to make sure that you are, if you're going to create this, you got to stick to it, and it's not just turn it on 1 year and then shut it down. However, I'm going to caveat that there's some, if you will, back doors. You know, there's dire situations, of course. You know, if somebody starts a plan 2 years later, if worst case scenario, they sold their business. Well, they no longer sponsor that company, and so, you know, sure, they can shut down the plan. If something happens where there's a, you know, kind of a financial hardship situation, they can't afford it anymore, there's ways to, you know, decrease down that benefit formula. There's ways to freeze it, you know, maybe stop it for a year or two. And it's really all on, you know, the strategy behind it is timing. It's about doing, you know, any type of decrease in contribution to these plans before anybody hits and reaches 1,000 hours in the year. So around the time when they're looking at their taxes, maybe look to see, okay, how are we looking like? Are we able to, you know, continue funding this amount, or do we need to scale back a little bit, or do we just need to put it on hold?
So again, it's one of those things. It's, you know, maybe what you do this year needs to be changed in the future. That's okay. Take advantage of what you are due or are allowed to do in the tax code. And to do that, you need to get in touch with Fong Jennings at QBI LLC. Fong, what is the best phone number for someone to reach you at if they want to talk about plan design or looking at their plan?
Sure. They could call me at, I mean, do you want me to just give my number out, Bill, or?
Sure. If you're okay with that.
Sure. It's 949-689-0133. And you know, anything that I do as far as just, you know, to have the conversation, to explore options, it's all complimentary. I just want to make sure that when we're looking at, you know, whether it be creating a new plan or assessing your current plan, you know, we want to make sure you're comfortable and we can run numbers. I have actuaries that will run the numbers, but I will definitely be the one that sits down and, you know, do the strategizing and really doing all the assessments, you know, with you so that, you know, there's clear understanding upfront on, you know, commitment levels and really what you're comfortable at with, you know, funding a budget and goals and whatnot. And, you know, and so once that comfort level is there, then we can actually run the calculations and then show you the end result of what that looks like.
Terrific information. Again, that number is 949-689-0133, or go to the website for QBI if you want to learn more about it. It's www.QBILLC.com. It's very simple. Fong, thank you so much. It, you know, this is a topic that we hear a lot from listeners that they want to learn more about, and you've really helped us understand some of the key elements of these types of plans and why people should be not satisfied with where they are. If they haven't had their plan looked at or reviewed in a number of years, it's really time to give Fong a call. So, Fong, thanks a lot.
Yeah.
I appreciate you coming on today, and I look forward to the next time.
Of course.
That we can speak.
Thank you so much, Bill. And if I could also, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm here.
Oh, okay. I just wanted to add really quickly that about the new California Cal Savers program that's coming out for any businesses and companies in California with 5 or more employees, full or part-time. The small pilot program is already in effect. to basically roll out, and that companies will have to set up some type of retirement plan for their employees.
Oh, okay. Well, we better get back on and tell people about that. So when is that? Is it a pilot program that runs for a certain period of time?
Yeah. So basically, California State Treasurer, you know, announced that this pilot's already launched actually in November, and that the full program will open to all eligible employers beginning July 1st of 2019. Basically, in his announcement, that the covered employers will have to begin enrolling in the program by July 1st, but the deadline is required based on the number of employees. So we're talking a minimum of 5 employees. So there's different tiers based on deadlines of meeting this. From 5 employees to 49, that's July of 2022 is when they have to do this. But anybody that has over 100 employees or more by July of 2020 needs to be in this program if they do not have any other, if they currently do not offer any ERISA retirement plan right now, they'll have to enroll into this California state mandated program. It's basically auto-enroll their employees into a payroll deduction IRA. The workers can opt out, but if not, then these workers are going to go into this CalSAVERS program. And it requires the workers to have 5% of their paycheck automatically deposit into a Roth IRA, and there's an auto escalation of 1% per year up to 8% of their pay. No employer contribution is required, but they're going to have to share in the cost of, you know, of maintaining this plan.
Okay. Wow. That's another reason to call Fong and learn
yeah.
more about this program. So once again, thank you so much for joining me today. It's really been a pleasure and a treat to have you on the show.
Thank you, Bill. Always the same with you. Have a great day.
Hey, everybody. It's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. One of the questions I get asked the most is, how do I grow the value of my business? I'm so busy working in it, I need to work on it. So we've created a special report for you on 10 tips to grow the value of your business. Just text the word DRIVERS to 44222 to get a special free report right to your inbox. That's DRIVERS to 44222. Text DRIVERS to 44222.
Thank you for listening to Exit Coach Radio.
Hi, everyone.